The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, Ed. Monsters, John. Monsters from the Id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 157.
Freakits in Space! With Michael Martinez.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And obviously our guest today is Michael Martinez with Welcome to the Show.
Thank you for that stunning introduction. That was awesome.
So let's start off with since you've never been on our show before, that means we get to ask you the one question we ask every new person, which is, what got you into writing and why did you gravitate towards genre fiction instead of, you know, like sexy romances?
I would be terrible at writing sexy romances. However, the writing was something I've always done. Pretty much since I was in high school, when I was writing for our school paper, all the way through to a career in newspapers, the Associated Press, ABCNews.com, magazine work, you name it. Always been a writer, always been a storyteller. It's something natural. And like most journalists, you always kind of have that sort of, man, if I could just someday write a novel or a screenplay or whatever. I mean, talk to any journalist. They got something in their drawer. Most of it's really embarrassing. and as for me, genre has also kind of been a big part of my life. I mean, I'm the Star Wars generation. I was 5 when A New Hope came out, and I was in the theater, and I remember seeing them all. It's one of the few real solid memories of my childhood that I have. And then add Dungeons and Dragons and Star Trek and all that other stuff to it. And, it really has been something that's been with me. I haven't been a huge geek in terms of going to conventions or anything like that, but it's always been in the mix.
Okay, so this makes me wonder a question, because when I ask this question, I get usually get a similar-ish response, like somebody grew up on genre, and that's kind of that it just made sense to kind of jump into writing genre. I'm really curious, do we all think that is actually probably the majority causal link between why people write genre in our particular field?
That's a really interesting question. I've only started recently interacting with, now I can say, my fellow authors, which still seems slightly specious. but there does seem to be a causality. You see this stuff, you read this stuff, you're into RPGs, and it just sort of takes off. I do think there's a link there. I mean, certainly not everybody can do it, but I think, it informs a lot of people.
I do think, Sean, I'm getting an echo. I do think, Sean, that Star Wars and its successor movies and properties has exploded the field of potential authors. Just, and on the heels of that, Dungeons and Dragons, you get science fiction and fantasy fans thinking, I want to do this too. And what is Dungeons and Dragons and a lot of role-playing if not storytelling? And it's not a hard leap to go from rolling dice and moving your wizard down a dungeon to imagining writing a story about alchemists in space.
Well, it makes a lot of sense to me for something like Dungeons and Dragons, because to run a Dungeons and Dragons campaign, at least a good one, you have to already be kind of a storyteller. So, I mean, the leap from going Dungeons and Dragons or any RPG for that matter to writing stories makes a lot of sense. But I don't think that a lot of genre writers are necessarily RPG people, although maybe I'm totally wrong. I played them when I was a kid, and I'm sure, Michael, you've mentioned Dungeons & Dragons already, so you did. I know Mike Cole has. I believe Stina Light has. Maybe I'm totally just baloney.
Well, I know that.
You are off base, Sean. There's a lot of role players in the writing community. They just come out of the woodwork.
Do you think it's the majority, though?
I don't know if it's the majority, but it's certainly a strong tradition. There's a lot of gamers who are writing these days, and Dungeons and Dragons and the other games are a big part of that. It is storytelling, it's character building, it's world creation, and for GMs and players alike, I do think there's a strong strain.
I recently interviewed Peter Brett for an Irish writing site, and one of the things he said was some of the first stuff he wrote was basically an extension of his D&D campaign. He obviously has gone on to bigger and better, but that in many ways is your first real stab at huge genre-based creativity by creating the worlds and scenarios.
I'm really curious now, because I feel like once the SFWA stop, you know, is done with all of the controversy, that should be the next thing they do, is like run a poll through all the membership. And
that'll be around 2014, sadly.
Yeah, I know, but that would be really cool to kind of get a lot of data. So like, you know, is it primarily fantasy writers who do the RPGing the most, or is it, you know, like figuring out who the groups were, and even looking at it just right down to the like age groups even.
The age groups you would get, because I mean, think about it. In 1977, what were the two things that came out? Advanced Dungeons and Dragons and Star Wars. They're like right there. 77, 78. You know, I'm probably off on my dates, but you just had that double whammy that was just this huge cultural tidal wave for people ages, you know, 5 to 15. So basically, anybody who's like, you know, 40 and up, that's where we started.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's the same today, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I know that you have some authors who are running, you know, campaigns at cons, and you know, it's been up on YouTube, so there's definitely a there. I don't know if it's a majority, but man, it's definitely influenced a lot of people. I'm one of my few geek credits was actually interviewing Gary Gygax once, which was... I was like bragging to my entire office, and they're like, "Who? Come on! He invented Dungeons and Dragons." They're like, "Oh, okay."
You played that Satan game, you weirdo.
Yes. Yeah. And they're actually, like, "Can you go back to covering the stuff that you were covering?" I'm like, "Oh, come on."
I actually met somebody whose mother was like that. When I used to play Rifts in high school, I brought the book over, and I was looking. It happened to be like the Vampire World book. And it was a cool looking book. It's not a great book. It's not their best one, but whatever. And she got like really upset, and she's like, "You can't look at that in my house." Like, it's not real. It's all imaginary. I don't want to be a vampire.
You know, those covers of those first edition AD&D books didn't help us either, really. I mean,
or the pictures in the monster manual.
Oh my God, no. Yeah. Not at all. Didn't do anything for the case.
Fair enough. Sorry, let's jump back to the novel really quick.
Yes.
So the very first question I really wanted to ask, excuse me, is probably one you may have been asked before, but I was curious about it. You have two primary narratives here, which is the narrative of Lieutenant Shayla Jane, who exists in what seems to be our future. And then you have Lieutenant Thomas Weatherby, who actually exists in a parallel or alternate past in the 18th century. So it's roughly around what would have been, I guess, the American Revolution. But obviously that doesn't happen in this book because the Americans suck, apparently. You don't like
America. No, the Americans are there. They're just not in America. They're on Ganymede.
Well, they suck. Bastards.
That's a very unfair characterization, Sean.
I know, I'm just teasing. So it's the two narratives, and they run side by side. There is a connection, but I won't tell you what the connection between the two is, because you should read the book, because the connection's not apparent in the first 100 or so pages. So if I told you, it would ruin the climax. So I won't say anything. But I'm curious, what inspired you to actually select these kind of split narratives in two different time periods, and at least in one case, absolutely for certain, is an alternate version of our past?
Well, you know, the alternate version of our past, where you have frigates in space, that was the first idea. That was the one that lit my head on fire and was like, I need to write that. And it took a few years, actually. This idea was brewing for about 8 years before I even started writing it. It took a few years before I thought of adding our future as sort of a separate setting and bringing them together. And yet they do come together. I think we can say that without being too spoilery. I just had this image in my head of an astronaut dealing with the potential of this. And it was such a moment. It's actually some of my favorite moments of the book are watching these future characters come to grips with the possibility of this alternate dimension where ships can do this and sail between the worlds. These are people who have to, take, atmosphere suits and spaceships and everything else. And everything is so gosh darn hard. And these guys are, zipping across the solar system in a bloody frigate. And just wrapping their heads around that was a lot of fun.
Paul, you had your hand up.
Yep, it is a lot of fun. I was curious as to what your inspirations for doing frigates in space, and of course the alchemical magical system that underpins that half of your dual dimensions.
Well, I this is a story I've told a few times. I remember I was unemployed at the time in Washington, D.C., and I walked by a Blockbuster store and saw the poster for Treasure Planet. And if nobody remembers, it was a Disney cartoon based on Treasure Island, but they had frigates in space. Mm-hmm. And the poster was actually really beautiful. You had this kid on the rigging sort of leaning over the side, very classic naval image. But he was obviously in space looking out towards, stars and planets and galaxies and whatnot. I'm like, oh my God, that is so cool. I have to rent this movie. And was utterly, completely disappointed by the movie. It was, sadly, sad to say, widely considered to be one of Disney's worst. I know. I hate saying it because obviously people put a lot of time and creativity into it. But I'm sorry. It wasn't that good. And then shortly after, I actually watched Master and Commander, and they brought that to film so very well. Mm. And I thought, oh my gosh, what if you combined the two? Now, you couldn't strap a rocket ship to the rear end of a frigate, because that just is dumb. So, for want of a better word. With my background in role-playing and everything else, my thought immediately went to Spelljammer, if anybody remembers that.
Absolutely.
And then, all right, overt magic? I don't know. But alchemy is period. It was there in the late 1700s. As a pseudoscience. And so you sit there and you think, well, what if the engine of this particular form of travel was alchemy? What if alchemy worked? And that just led me down a whole rabbit hole of ideas and possibilities. And then you bring in historical figures who practiced it, and oh my gosh, and what if you did this? And it just blew it wide open.
Indeed, Treasure Planet meets Newton's canon.
Well, this actually makes me wonder, too, because I kind of asked Paul this similar wording of the question, and he said he knew the answer, and I thought it was going to be a different answer, because I didn't think it would have been Treasure Planet, although now it makes sense, because it is a more recent example. But does anybody remember, there has to – I I cannot remember the title, but there was a book. It was either written hundreds of years ago or it was written like in the 1940s, in which somebody imagined a similar concept of, you know, typical ships of the line floating up into space and flying. I don't remember if it had alchemy involved, but I can't remember the name of it.
You know, I've looked, and I remember when I had this idea, and over the years while I wasn't writing it, thinking, you know, somebody's going to do this or somebody's done it. And I looked and looked and looked and looked and didn't really find a lot. I know where you're coming from. It almost seems like low-hanging fruit that, you know, it kind of somebody had to have come up with this.
Well, no, I don't think it's low-hanging fruit. I think, like, in genre fiction, like, almost everything's been done anyway. But it's the fact that this is not actually a very common idea. And I don't know why. It might be because most people would go, that's just silly. You can't have space. Yeah, you can't have ships of the line in space. But you actually can. It kind of works. It's kind of cool. but I know that there is, and I swear, like, I wish I had, like, on the Coot Street podcast, their knowledge, because they would probably be like, oh, it's this book, and it was written by some weird French guy.
If anybody listening actually knows the answer, please email all of us, because we need to know.
Yeah, because I really would like to know, and I cannot remember if it was relatively contemporary, like an early 20th century sci-fantasy, I don't know, or if it was even earlier and it was somebody else imagining that, in which case it would have been, there would have been like no science in it whatsoever. It would have been like, right, somehow you just go in space and there's no vacuum.
You just sail off the end of the world, which people back in the day thought would happen.
Yeah, so it may have been, I don't, just can't remember. So hopefully somebody will think of it, because I think that would be very interesting for all of us to see how somebody from way back when would have written it and look at the two books and almost as in an unintentional comparison, as it were. So, but this actually is related to another question I'm very interested in, and I'm sure Paul will want to ask more questions about the alchemy later. But actually, I'm really curious about the fact that your naval battles, and I was really happy with this, because the very first naval battle is fairly early in the book. It's like page, I don't know, 25 or 30 or something like that. You actually take into account that space is three-dimensional. So your ships don't just like run at each other like they would be on the sea, which you see lots of times in like science fiction movies where the ships just run at each other and shoot at each other that way, and it's like there's no concept like you could go down and come under him and do all kinds of stuff. And in that very first battle, that's what your ship actually does. That it realizes it's the HMS Daedalus realizes that it's basically outgunned. It has like 12 fewer guns, and so it's got one shot to do major damage, and so it has to like bank this certain way to get on top of it, so it shoots down onto the deck of the ship, because these are classic like main ship of the line kind of stuff. And I loved seeing that, because even in space, you're not treating it as a traditional ocean. You're treating it as every aspect of it. You can move. You can move through anything. And I wondered, what made you decide to write in this manner? What was the inspiration to actually rework how naval battles would take place for space? And I don't know, just talk about it, because it's cool.
Well, thanks. Anytime you're doing world building, and I think this kind of goes back to my journalism experience, you know, I find that you have to ask rigorous questions of what you do. So I want frigates in space. Okay. And I want them to fight because that's cool. How is that going to be different? Well, you don't have water. You are going much faster. Because the way I've set things up, you travel in the void a lot faster than you do on the surface of a world. And then you think it through and you're like, okay, and then they'll come at each other at the typical broadside, except they don't have to. And so it sort of became this three-dimensional joust rather than slowly creeping up on the ocean toward each other and then just laying into each other with a massive broadside, which is traditional naval battle. You have to be nimble and quick and understand three dimensions. And, you know, I feel like even in this book, I've scratched the surface of the possibilities of what you can do. Some of the things that I'm thinking of for an indeterminate future work at this point, would be what happens if you have a three-dimensional battle between two or more ships in an asteroid field? And think about the physics of that for a second. That's cool.
And they would be, you're talking like ship of the line type ships, like classic, yes. Technically wood ships. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, these are basically the way that they maneuver in three dimension is they have additional sails because they are catching the solar wind and the sun currents, which are, of course, things I just made up.
Well, solar wind exists. It's just
it does.
It's just not wind.
It's not frying you in this world. So how do you move in those three dimensions? Well, you know, I actually thought of the planes on a submarine, and that's how they move in three-dimensional water. And so I kind of created sails on each side of the ship so that they could move in those three dimensions. And then obviously a simple rudder isn't necessarily going to give you enough surface area to catch anything. So you put a rudder sail on the back, something big and long. And then I'm thinking of this, and to my mind, it does look like a sort of giant spindly blowfish coming at you at high speed with cannons on the side. Which is a fun image.
And there is also, I guess, somewhat of a necessity in your world for them to actually take on the three-dimensional space because, you know, like in a lot of classical science fiction, you know, the ships are – they're bulky, they can take lots of hits, or like in Star Trek, they have shields. Unless they're very outnumbered, they don't have to engage in these kinds of different maneuvers. But your ship's actually, a cannonball can literally go through the hull because they're wood and they're basically protected from the void, as they call it, by alchemy. So that's what's protecting the ship. It's not magic shields.
Right, there's no magic shields. And I mean, now there are certainly ships... not every cannonball got through every hull. You're talking about 2 feet of planking in some areas, in sure. The most sensitive areas of a ship. And I mean, it takes a pretty heavy cannonball to break through 2 feet of wood. It does happen. And, you know, those gun ports actually don't help matters because that gives you just enough surface area to weaken and thus you can get a cannonball through along the edges. But yeah, I mean, the equation's very much changed because you get one really good shot off, and it's very easy for your opponent then to come around and finish you in a very real and final way.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of the very fascinating things that happens in that very first battle is they happen to hit at just the right spot on one of the ships and are very fortunate, but still bad news because once you have one... Like, for example, one of the things that you have in your world, in this particular world, is the idea of the lodestones as being in control of things like the air, but also the mm-hmm. gravity, because obviously it's the void. What the hell is my cat doing? Excuse me. I'm working. go away. Jerk. Don't play with me.
It's a space cat.
Yeah, he thinks he is. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
So that the alchemy, right, you have the lodestones and they control the air and they also control the gravity. So one of the big concerns is if one of the lodestones gets shot, suddenly a section of the ship doesn't have gravity. So you've got like, you know, I think it's like you say a 1.5-ton cannon that can just float around and crush people.
if it floats off in the wrong direction, then it comes crashing down through the ship and through the hull and you have additional problems. So, you know, naval battles historically were very, very messy, damaging, god-awful affairs. I mean, you had, for bigger ships of the line, like the 74s, you had 700 men aboard in a tiny space. And when you get a couple of cannonballs going through, you've got splinters everywhere. You're just showering these people with such wooden shrapnel. It's just mind-blowing. And the destruction that they would wreak was horrible. So, you know, it translates, and then you have these additional considerations. The lodestones, they're alchemically treated, and they provide the air and the heat and the gravity, and if you lose one, you know, there's a good chunk of your ship that's uninhabitable and stuff's floating around. And your men may float off into the void and, you know, never to be found.
Oh, poor bastards.
You've gone through a lot of work with this. I also noticed lots of the most of the conflicts occur in gravity wells around planets because those are where ships are likely to actually run into each other.
It would be, yeah, again, sort of the cosmology that I've set up. You to go between planets, you have very strong sun currents linking them together. So basically, if you were to have a naval battle between planets, it would be equivalent of two supersonic jets trying to fire at each other with a pistol as they pass by in opposite directions. And that would be hard.
That would be hard.
To say the least. I'm really just fascinated by the whole idea of classical ships of the line flying around and shooting at each other and the mechanics of how that would have to work. It's just mind-boggling, but also kind of just really cool.
It was a lot of fun to just think about the rules of it, you know. And again, yeah. I think that's the best part of world building is sort of, you know, back-testing it, you know, yeah. and putting it through its paces. And I'm still doing that. I mean, you know, as I write forward, you know, what happens here? Well, what if you do that? And you know, you end up with sometimes even cooler stuff.
I don't know what are you going to do to us next time, Michael? What the heck is coming for us?
Well, you know, I'd love to tell you, as of this particular moment, the details aren't for public release, but I feel confident that you have not heard the last of Sailing Ships in Space.
Awesome. I can't wait. I want to see more.
Well, you know about the gravity of the affair, don't you, Sean?
No.
That is a novella. I've serialized it on my website at michaeljmartinez.net for those of you who are at a computer and listening. It's a 12-part piece dealing with Horatio Nelson's first command. Naturally, this is on Ganymede as opposed to the Caribbean. And a little bit of trouble he gets himself into.
Oh, well, that'll be fun. I've got more to read.
There you go.
Awesome.
There you go.
Okay, so switching gears really quick, unless, Paul, you have something that's related to this?
I do. I was curious what your motivation was in tying historical figures into the alchemical system you came up with, Michael. What was the motivation and inspiration for doing that? You hadn't read the book. I thought you did. So what was your inspiration?
Well, so you look at, you know, you come up with the idea of alchemy and it is a period sort of mysticism. And as a former reporter, I'm very research oriented. So, you know, I read a ton of stuff. And then you see who are some of the more interesting people of the day. And you just can't help but go, man, this is perfect. I feel like history has served up so much good stuff on a platter for me to play with. you look at some of the great figures of alchemy in the late 1700s, and you're like, this is tailor-made. This is perfect. Paul's read the book. I won't spoil it too bad, but there are two alchemists who are historical figures, and one of those alchemists had a mentor whose name got lent to the primary baddie here. And you're just, I'm reading this stuff going, this is absolutely perfect, and I'm going to basically appropriate this.
So you did.
And so I did. And, you know, it's obviously, I think where the fun happens is appropriating it in a really awesome, fun, creative way. But, you know, some of the historical research that I've done, you're just reading this to go, and man, this is perfect. How can I not piggyback on this? And I think that's the fun of writing alternate history, because there's so many fascinating people in history, so many fascinating events, and we get to play what if and sort of tweak that a little bit. And that's just been great. It's been a lot of fun to play with.
Okay, so just switch kind of gears really quick to, I mean, it's kind of related to this, but I was really interested myself as being a what is called a post-colonial scholar. I kind of latched on to the fact that obviously in your past world, we're dealing with the British Empire, and there are other empires that obviously exist. They mentioned the Spanish, and there's the Dutch are kind of doing a weird thing. I don't really understand the Dutch, so...
Who does? No, I'm kidding.
So
I'm
mean.
Kidding. The Dutch are wonderful.
Yeah, well, they are wonderful. They're lovely people, and mm-hmm. I hear they have beautiful, beautiful places.
Yes.
And I don't know what Dutch food is, but I imagine it's good.
If it's anything like Belgian food, I'm sold. Yeah. That was awesome.
They have sausages, right?
I couldn't tell you. I've never been.
Oh, maybe that's Danish. Maybe Danish is more sausagey.
Could be.
All I know is it's got to be good. So.
Absolutely.
But any case, right? So you've set this in obviously the kind of the height of the empires, as it were, and in particular your focus is on the British Empire and their kind of move into the kind of farther reaches of our solar system. And I'm really curious, well, A, like why did you want to set it in that period? I mean, obviously you said earlier that you wanted to do it primarily because you were trying to imagine regular kind of old-fashioned wood ships shooting off into space, but I mean, you could have picked. You didn't have to necessarily take the historical elements with you. So, why this particular moment in the British Empire? Did you kind of? What was your vision, I guess, for including that?
Well, you know, obviously, if you look at some of the influences for this book, you have to go back to C.S. Forrester, Patrick O'Brien. C.S. Forrester did the Horatio Hornblower series. Patrick O'Brien did Master and Commander and the Aubrey Matron series. Those are really the pinnacle of Napoleonic era naval fiction, and I that's always been attracted to me. It's such a time of swashbuckling adventure, honor and duty, the potential for stories historically throughout that era. I would say from the Seven Years' War to Napoleon's final 100 days. It just so much, immense amount of global change, cultural change, the people thinking different ways about government and the technologies that came out. It just seemed like it was such a fascinating time to put it there. I could have gone earlier. The Golden Age of Piracy from roughly the 1650s to the 1720s and 30s. That was another possibility, but I also felt that, I don't know, pirates were a little overdone. I there is a pirate in the book because I couldn't resist, but you have to have a pirate, man. But I just felt that the storytelling potential and sort of that nice big epic sweep, this period was just perfect for it.
I have a question which I kind of know the answer to because you've told me I had spotted what few people have seemed to have noticed, but why is the British Empire and everybody else going into space rather than colonizing the Americas?
Well, that's because in the setting of our alternative history, there are no Americas.
Dun, dun, dun.
Sorry, took them out. You know, I thought about that early on when I'm thinking, man, wouldn't it be great? And they could colonize the solar system and you could have, you know, Jupiter representing this and Venus representing that. And you got Mercury and then you could have a couple of analogs that don't make sense, but would be a lot of fun to play with. And then, of course, the other question, well, why don't they just go to America? Because it's a nice big land that there are only a few, you know, unfortunate Native Americans there. And so I didn't really have a good answer. So I, being the god of my own little world, I sat kind of erased the Americas. Sorry, but I think it's worth it. And then when I made that decision, it opened up other possibilities that I'm looking forward to exploring down the road in terms of, well, if you have two dimensions and they are perhaps connected in some way, how does the disappearance of those Americas play in? And that led me down to a different road of all kinds of good stuff, which you will have to wait for because I'm not done yet.
Have you ever read Two Hawks from Earth, Philip Jose Palmer?
Nope. I will tell you guys right now, and this is a little bit of an admission, the extent of my genre reading is almost embarrassingly poor. So, no, unfortunately, I have not read it.
Well, guess who has homework?
I know, right?
Well, I've read a billion different things as a certain genre author has mentioned to me, so.
Yes.
So yeah. There's that.
Yeah, you do have quite the knowledge, sir.
That was the one thing I've noticed. Paul is kind enough to give me a review in SF Signal, and the stuff he was mentioning, I'm like, wow, this guy has read a lot of stuff and tied it in really well. Like, I was impressed. And I'm not just kissing up because I'm on your podcast.
It's Sean's podcast. I'm just the co-host.
No, you're not. You're a regular host, sir. Shush your mouth.
Right.
Anyway, oh gosh, some of the Americas are gone. I'm kind of depressed now.
Don't be. You know, the United States exists. It simply has just gotten moved to Ganymede. Think of Philadelphia, and then like a massive crescent of Jupiter hanging over Independence Hall, roughly 14 times the size of the moon.
I mean, come on. That's an image you got to go for, Sean.
I mean, I want to see that, but I don't want to wake up to that every day because that's terrifying.
Well,
do you guys know anything about Jupiter? That place is a scary place.
Well, yes, the actual real Jupiter would fry you with radiation like you wouldn't believe.
I'm not even worried about that. I'm worried about all the asteroids. I'm worried about like all the stuff it's going to throw at you.
Yeah, well, Jupiter is quite a magnet for all of the stray asteroids, comets, and everything else that comes hurtling through the solar system, which, by the way, has helped Earth out quite a bit.
Yep, Shoemaker Levy 9.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
But this Jupiter in the past, in my alternate history, is a little bit different.
It's a nicer Jupiter.
It's a nicer Jupiter.
It's a nicer Jupiter.
The kind Lord, gentler Jupiter.
Oh, wonderful. okay, so we've been talking a lot about the kind of past stuff. We've kind of been ignoring Shayla Jane. Lieutenant Shayla Jane, just to make sure we get her full title in there. So I want to switch to actually talking about the more our worldy stuff, the sort of future stuff. It's set, I think, it was 300 or 200 years in the future. 300?
It's actually set in the year 2132.
Oh, I'm sorry, 100-ish years.
100-ish years, which gives you the opportunity to have a mining colony on Mars, but still necessarily looking to explore some of the more outer worlds. I did a lot of thinking about exploration and have done a lot of research on Mars, and that just seemed a good time period to have sort of the beginnings of Mars exploitation as opposed to exploration. And thus you'd want to have a colony there, so that you can, you know, then have a presence for what goes next.
And to mine the hell out of it.
There's a lot of stuff there.
Now, deuterium, I think you said?
Deuterium. It's heavy water, actually. And it's would be very useful for fusion reactors. So once we get around to making viable, stable, commercially available fusion reactors, deuterium, which is fairly rare on Earth but more common on Mars, would make a Mars settlement a lot more profitable. And exploration is, if nothing else, historically been a for-profit enterprise. I mean, if you look at history, I mean, the whole reason Columbus came over to the Americas was because he wanted gold. A lot of the great naval exploration was because people wanted more resources. And, you know, I can't fathom that we would explore Mars just to plant a flag when we're not even in competition really with anybody. Mars settlement would have to be commercial.
Well, the Chinese already have a base there, so.
Yes, they do.
I mean, obviously.
They're already on Saturn. What are you talking about?
Yeah. well, I mean, it certainly, it makes sense, particularly when you look at the situation now where, in fact, let's be honest, like NASA is not technically a for-profit industry, but it has supported or the creation of products which have then been used for profit. So, I mean, when you look at the long list of stuff that's come out of NASA, right, half of that stuff we now use, like, in our daily lives in ways we probably most people don't even realize, which is really sad because then they poo-poo on NASA. And I'm like, don't do that. NASA is your best friend. Totally. Trust me. When you go to the doctor and you need a CAT scan, thank NASA that we can look inside your body and find bad bits. But anyway, that's not a daily thing. But it's interesting because when you look at now, there's obviously a lot of talk about the privatization of space industry. I don't know what you call it. So we've got like SpaceX and Elon Musk, who thinks he's going to create like a vegetarian paradise on Mars, which good luck with that guy. It's not going to happen. Not going to happen. Sorry. but you've got all of these industries that are, you know, like SpaceX, there's the Galactic.
Virgin Galactic. You got Dragon. Is that SpaceX as well? No.
The Dragon capsule is SpaceX, I think.
Okay.
It? Yeah. But they've got like 5 or 6 bazillion things going on. But a point is right, all of these profit-based people, so Elon Musk is associated with PayPal, and Charles Bronson?
Richard Branson.
Thank
Richard
you.
Branson. Charles Bronson. No, that would be awesome.
Wrong guy. Richard Branson, excuse me. And he's associated with like Virgin Records and Virgin Atlantic, which is by far the best international airline you could ever fly. But all of these interests being involved. And so it makes a lot of sense that in your world that same sort of capitalistic enterprise is involved, because, of course, the reality is that's probably what's going to get us to build a colony of any kind on Mars, is actually some sort of a profit motive.
Yeah, altruism has rarely come into exploration, and I really don't think it's going to. There has to be a good reason. I mean, there's certainly plenty of people who would raise their hand and say, I want to go to Mars because, darn it, it's the right thing to do. But are you going to get to raise enough money to actually get there, to build your spacecraft, to figure out the logistics, to get somebody there so they can stand around and go, yep, I'm here. You got to do something when you're there.
Well, first off, if it was me, I wouldn't be like, well, I'm here. I would be like doing dances. I would like get up and do, you know, like in South America, they got those really big, like hieroglyphic things in the sand kind of stuff.
Nazca.
Yeah,
lines.
I'd make those.
The Nazca lines. Oh, that'd be great.
I'd do that on Mars. I would.
You know what
a hotel.
You should do? You could moonwalk on Mars, and that would blow people's minds.
I know, right? And I could do it to the music and every. Yep. So yeah. I would do all sorts of crazy stuff. I'd do handstands and flips. I'd cause an avalanche on Mons Olympus.
Olympus Mons.
Olympus
yeah.
Mons.
Yeah.
There you go.
You could do that.
Yep.
And then we'd dig up your bones later.
No, I'm gonna like do it from my cool space floaty spaceship, and I'm gonna go.
Wow.
And then I'll do it. I'm not gonna be there like on top and die. That's stupid, right? It's already a one-way trip. So if I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna get as much fun as I can out of it.
Well, that's the problem. You can't make it a one-way trip. No sane human being is going to go to Mars on a one-way trip.
I'll go.
Oh, all right. Like I said, wait for it.
But no, that's really true. Yeah, because I just don't imagine that would be very fun.
Mm.
Like you're here now, then you've got like 6 weeks, and then you're gonna die.
Yeah.
Have fun.
Right around probably month two of your voyage, you'll try to want to turn your spaceship around. And unfortunately, celestial mechanics won't let you.
No, because once you get up to speed, you can't just like turn around and start firing. Things just won't work.
Yeah, exactly. You'll end up shooting off. Next thing you know, you're, you know, Alpha Centauri. And quite dead.
In like a couple hundred years, you'll be dead. And
exactly.
In Alpha Centauri. So you'll be the first human to make it there.
Yes.
Yeah, in 25,000 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
it's
unless...
a bit of a hike.
Unless the new news about NASA supposedly doing tests on photons to see if it is possible to bend space for the warp drive, the Alcubierre drive. Yeah.
There has been some great, great research just in the past year or two on warp drive, on literally bending space in order to achieve faster than light speed. And let me tell you, it's really cool to watch.
I know.
That would be cool.
Yeah. And if they need like a test monkey, because they can't use monkeys anymore, but if you need somebody who just sits in there and pushes the button and goes, wee, I'll do it. I will be the first person in a warp drive ship. I'll do it. I don't care.
Please send your psychiatric medications too. Sorry.
You know, I'll just stay home and write about the speculative fiction about you slowly losing your mind when you realize that it's a one-way trip.
No, because I'll go to Alpha Centauri.
Haven't you seen Event Horizon, Sean?
Okay, first off, That movie's got Sam Neill in it, and that guy is never in a movie where things go right. One movie that Sam Neill's in where things go right for his character.
The one where he's the painter on the South Sea Island with the women. It's an Australian film. I can't think of the name.
Piano?
Of it. No, not the piano. No.
Okay, let me change this. Name a genre film that goes right for Sam Neill.
That's a harder.
Yeah, you got nothing, right? Because Jurassic Park, dinosaurs come and try to kill everybody and succeed pretty much. And then he comes back for Jurassic Park 3 and gets screwed over then too because he's an idiot and he should just tell people to go to hell. Let's see. He's in one of the Omens, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's obviously not going to go right because creepy demon child, right? He was in Event Horizon in which he gouges out his own eyes. That's fun.
That's great. Right?
I wonder if he ate them.
I hope so.
I mean, they must have been tasty, right?
You know, look, if you're crazy enough to do that, you're probably going to sample.
Yeah, I mean, I would. You know, just saying. Anyway, we're way
I'm not sending
far.
You anywhere.
We've gone way off topic. Well, let's actually go back to the book for a second. In the standard future, Michael, the book starts off with what I should have put in the review. Now the term has come to me. 14 events on Mars, and what was the inspiration for using those sorts of events to draw Lieutenant Jane and company into the plot?
Well, you have to basically the whole idea was, you know, these dimensions will come together. I don't think I'm spoiling the book too badly. I think we pretty much did that in the marketing. So the question is how, and so that's where a lot of cool research into quantum physics, string theory, multiple dimension theory, all of the real scientific stuff behind the possibility of parallel dimensions came in, and figuring out how that might manifest. Now, I'm not a scientist. I dropped potato head math in college, so I got nothing. But you know, at least gave me the foundation to sort of play with those ideas and figure out. You know, you want to make them, I think 40 in events is a great word for it, because you want to give them that sort of scientific sort of background, because that's how these folks would look at it. They wouldn't jump to the conclusions of, you know, wow, this is another dimension happening right here. Because if that happened on page 8, that would be really boring. So you wanted to give it sort of a mystery, and you wanted to have them push their mental boundaries and to really have to come to that really inescapable and very scary conclusion of what's going on. You're totally wrecking people's very safe perceptions of what time and space and physics and how the universe works. You're taking all that out back and shooting it, and that's hard. And I really enjoyed it. You see so many, science fiction movies where just the utterly most insane, impossible, crazy things happen, and the protagonist looks at it and goes, "Huh," and then he cocks his rifle and he shoots it. That's no, you know, take a moment, wrap your head around this. Your world just got, you know. All of human history just got rewrote. All of science just got tossed out the window. Take a moment and wrap your head around that if you can. And that I think was the reason I included it and built up to it in that way, just to really have that really neat moment that I don't see enough of people going, oh my God.
No, because you're rewriting your entire worldview.
Exactly.
You know, when we do that in any other context, you know, like we learn something about a religion is wrong, and like it takes centuries for people to get over that, right? So like things like the world's flat, and like the world's flat, and it took a long ass time for people to get over it.
Yeah. Right? You know, the Earth is not the center of the universe. It's right. Not even the center of the solar system.
Right. People got killed for some of those things.
Hey, Galileo just got pardoned, what, a few years ago? Seriously.
Yeah,
it's
well,
just sad.
Yeah, and but that kind of stuff happens, and it's and granted we're dealing with a slightly future, hopefully slightly more realistic world, so it won't take them centuries to realize this is real.
In the book, they will realize it fairly quickly, whether they like it or not.
Right, but that shattering kind of moment, to kind of explore that even just a little bit, I think is really an interesting idea, because it isn't, as you say, it's not explored. It's actually kind of just ignored. Like, I mean, I think like Paul and I just watched Transformers and like the only one who seems particularly like, holy crap, what the hell is happening to me, is the main character, Sam Witwicky, who has like a minor freak out at one moment because his car's chasing him.
Right.
But like later, like, you know, the like leader of the vice president or whatever the hell that guy's name is, played by John Voight, he's just like, oh, there's aliens, whatever. Like,
yeah,
you know, like giant robot aliens, that's not a big deal. The rest of the world, not really, like, whatevs.
Yeah,
like,
what, you know, well, that's John Voight, though. He has seen a lot.
Fair enough.
But yeah, exactly. You know, there's just one of my favorite moments in there is when they're just kind of like sitting there going, oh my God, that just happened. And I don't believe it. How could this possibly happen? And that's when the really interesting thinking comes in. And that's when the really interesting theorizing and them really struggling to deal with it. And that was a lot of fun.
Yes, it was indeed.
So, I'm really curious about Shayla Jayne, because some of the things you kind of learn in the beginning, just to kind of talk about some of what you tell us about her character without ruining mm-hmm. other parts of her. So she's sort of on Mars and doesn't really want to be there. She actually wants to be a pilot. That's her primary interest. But she's kind of like running ops on the Mars colony and her life sucks. Basically. And I'm really curious about this character because she's kind of embedded in this world she doesn't want to be in, but yet now is kind of investigating this very strange event that happens on Mars. Tell us a little bit about Shayla and kind of building her personal conflicts into this world.
Well, you know, Shayla is somebody who wants to be an explorer. She joined the astronaut corps because she wants to be in space. She wants to be sort of that classic astronaut exploring all the strange new worlds and all of that great stuff. And she's not. She is babysitting miners at a mining colony where they dig in the dirt all day. And her job is to make sure the airlocks work and ensure that the supply ships land on time and get out on time and break up the brawls and confiscate the booze. And it's awful. This is somebody who really wants to be doing something more and isn't. And I think there have been times in everybody's life that is perfectly relatable. And I think the neat thing about this is that this story in a lot of ways gives her the opportunity to explore in ways that she never thought possible. And I think it's one of the reasons why she, you know, at first she's sort of hesitant, but just sort of uninspired with this assignment of figuring out what's going on Mars. But as things go on, she really seizes on it. And it's like, this is different. And it ignites that spark in her. And so I think, and it's a great parallel with Weatherby, who is an explorer, in addition to being, you know, obviously a soldier, and he gets to go to Venus and sees all this stuff. He's a little blasé about it. So just having those two coming at it from different angles, I thought was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about her, the stuff we've already talked about her conflict and not wanting to be there, but of course finding her own kind of reason or place in this world she doesn't really want to be a part of, in the kind of detective work she does. But it's also really interesting, it's fairly early that one of the conflicts she has right from the start is the conflict between the JCS, is that it?
JSC,
sorry, I got them backwards. And the mining company, right?
Right.
So one of the things that immediately comes up is, I'm not ruining anything, like the very first chapter, there's an earthquake and it's Mars, so they're not supposed to have earthquakes. So it freaks everybody out. And they're like, what the hell's going on? And immediately, one of the first conflicts is the mining company does not want any delays because there's good shit down in that hole, and they got to get it.
Right.
And but of course that's one of her. She's got to kind of ride that the line between trying to find the answers, but at the same time not ticking off the mining company that is essentially keeping this place afloat.
Right. And again, I think that really goes back to that conflict of, the desire, the really pure human desire to explore and to see what's around the other bend, placed in conflict with the fact that, people got to make money if this thing's going to work. Yeah. And making it a commercial enterprise sort of let me play with sort of the politics of exploration and put poor Shayla right in the middle of it and have her sort of wrestling with that in her own head, and understanding that as much as she would like to be out in space and, on a really awesome exploration mission, her responsibility is to these miners to ensure that they can still make a paycheck. And if that means dealing with the executives, then that's what she's got to do.
It's not glamorous, but a girl's got to do what a girl's got to do.
Well, and it goes back to a sense of duty, which is, I think, an interesting theme sort of played out in the book as well. The characters have various duties, and the duty comes with a cost at times. Mm-hmm. So both of the main characters have issues of duty and conflict within that they have to work out.
And their types of duty that's such a weird way of phrasing that. The things that they do in the service of duty are drastically different. So like Weatherby, he's essentially a servant for the Empire. I'm using servant probably incorrectly there, but right, his duty is in service of his ship, in the service of the people under his command, and of course in service of the people who command him, and then by extension in service of the Empire, of the
king and country,
right? Whereas her service is a slightly different, right? She's doing a duty that is part of her job, but also kind of develops over time through the novel into something more important. It's not just the job. There's actually something much more of a value, I guess I would say, a value that's happening in the service of doing her job. But she's not doing it for king and country. She's just kind of there and doing, kind of going with the motions, and that kind of develops and changes over time.
She's doing it to follow her dream. And I mean, she is a member of a military organization. She has a sense of duty and honor. But this is her stepping stone to something greater. And she has to understand, that duty, comes in a lot of different ways. And Weatherby's sense of duty is challenged as well. I mean, mm-hmm. there are points in the novel where he has to really think, okay, is there something more than king and country? And if that's the case, who do I get in bed with to further that, even if it is an enemy? That's something that he has to wrestle with as well. They're both sort of looking at greater good and your duty that you've sworn an oath to versus the duty perhaps to something even larger. So that was a lot of fun to play with both of them.
It's an interesting contrast between their different sets of duty, their different responsibilities, their different changes and growths in character across the novel as Weatherby tracks across the solar system, and Jane continually has to deal with more and more strange crap and really getting a handle on what's really going on and why. Yeah. They both have to rise to the occasion and decide who they are and what they have to deal with.
Yeah, there's definitely, you want to have characters that have that great arc to ensure that, you're rooting for them. I think both of them had a lot of room to grow. They were in positions of, they're not necessarily in positions where their full potential is being met, but they're not in positions to argue. So to watch them grow and change and understand what they can do and what they're capable of, that was a lot of fun to see them grow like that.
Yeah. Okay, so it's time to get to some of our boring questions.
Okay.
Which is, this is the most boring question we'll ever ask you.
Okay.
What is your favorite color? No, I'm just kidding.
I'm already asleep.
No. okay, so just really quick, to kind of, before we get to our silly question, which is, what can we expect from you in the near future? And we know that you mentioned a couple times already that you're working on some other stuff, but obviously you may be bound and gagged from saying anything about that. So, I mean, I guess the question really is, that was not English, I don't think. I'm going to delete that.
What should readers and fans expect from you in the near future, Michael?
And where might you be appearing if you are maybe going to a convention or something like that in the relatively near future?
Right. Well, first of all, I'll plug the novella again because that was a lot of fun. That's available on my website for free at the moment and will, you know, give you a great sort of introduction to the whole concept of frigates in space and is a nice little adventure in and of itself. Let's just say I'm not done playing in this sandbox. The end of the Daedalus incident has a wide, wide, super wide open door that I plan on driving through with a large truck. And so one way or another, it ain't over. I will say the novel is very well self-contained, but this is a lot of fun. I love this setting. So I think, my immediate work will be in continuing the stories that I've started here. And I'm really looking forward to that. As far as appearances, I will be at Mysterious Galaxy Bookstore in Redondo Beach, California, on August 17th. So y'all should come out and check that out. I'm actually going to California for my day job for a week. That's where my company's headquartered. And I'm like, well, why don't I do a signing at this really awesome bookstore? And so I am. And then I'm going to be at WorldCon. So anybody who's going, I'm on three different panels. I'm moderating the Mars and/or Bust panel, which I'm very excited about because there are people who are much smarter than me. And we're going to talk about how best to explore Mars. Mm-hmm. That's at Sunday at 10 a.m. So I expect all four of the audience members to ask a lot of questions because it's ungodly early on a Sunday and then people are going to be on it, whatever. It'll be fun. You should come, even if you're hungover, even if you haven't gone to bed yet. stop in.
I'll be there. So if I see you, I will yell something and then shove my microphone in your face.
Awesome. I love that. I've done it for so many years as a reporter. I'm looking forward to the tables turning. And then I'm doing a signing on September 12th at Singularity & Company in Brooklyn, the fantastic science fiction bookstore there. And then September 19th, I am doing a reading and signing at the Tenafly, New Jersey Public Library, because that's just kind of fun, and I like libraries, and people should support them. And that's all I got for now. And I tweet, and I blog, and all of that great stuff.
Yep, and maybe by the time this goes up, there may not be any copies left, but you do have signed copies of The Daedalus Incident at a place called Housing Works Bookstore in NYC.
Yes, Housing Works Bookstore. It is a completely donation-run bookstore. The books are donated, the time's donated. All the proceeds go to helping homelessness and AIDS in New York City. The Tor.com bash, 5th anniversary bash, was held there. I had copies of the book fresh from the printer finally, which was a beautiful thing. So I signed a couple and said, go sell them. There's like a 3-week window where this is the only bookstore in the world that will carry them. So they are there unless they've been sold. In which case you'll have to wait until August 13th, which is when the print book will be in stores and will be shipped to you if you've pre-ordered online. And that's very exciting. I can't wait.
Yeah, hopefully I don't know about hopefully because it's for a charity, so obviously they want to get their money quicker to help more people. But if not, by the time this goes up, definitely grab yourself a copy if they're still available.
Yes, if you're in the New York area, go, run.
Yeah. And
if there's a demand, tell them to contact me and I'll sign more because that just, you can't not support that stuff.
Absolutely. And I'll make sure there's a link to that to your post about it and everything so they can do that and find cool. That stuff out. All right, and then the most obvious question ever, which is where can folks find you?
I am blogging at my site michaeljmartinez.net and I'm on Twitter at mikemartinez72 and I don't do Facebook because I don't.
It's probably for the best.
It really is.
It's a time sink.
Oh, God, yes.
All right, and now for the silly question.
All right.
Which is, if one planet in our solar system were to turn into a living organism, which would you want to turn into that living organism, and why?
Pluto.
It's not a planet. It's not a planet anymore.
Technically not a planet.
Neptune.
Why?
Because if there are worlds suddenly spontaneously turning into living organisms, I want a little distance because I don't know if said organism is going to be well disposed to us or not. If the moon turned into an organism and decided it wanted to, say, eat people, that would be bad. At least Neptune will have to work to get here. I'm very practical about this.
That's awesome. All right.
Very good question. Best question ever.
It's a silly question, and I like it. And he made a great answer. It's very logical. So, all right. Well, so everybody should go check out the book, The Daedalus Incident. It is available in ebook currently, and then you said August 13th. Yeah, August 13th is when the print book comes out. So if you're disposed to print, you can wait, although you shouldn't.
And the audiobook is also available on August 13th. And there is a sample up on Amazon's site right now. And that guy is awesome. I could listen to him read the phone book. Because you listen to that and you're like, oh, my God, what is he going to do? What is he going to do? I can't listen. It's going to mess with my head. Oh, wow. Wow, this is good. Okay, keep reading. So it's really good. You should totally check it out.
Excellent. So, yeah, and I'll make sure everybody knows where to find that. So go buy the book, then buy 10 more copies.
That'd be great.
Distribute them to yourself and then tell your friends to buy 10 copies for themselves. So
because you want more frigates in space, people. You really do.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it'll make sure that he makes $1 million so he can keep writing them.
You know, I'll keep writing them anyway because that's just what I do.
I know, but
but the $1 million would be great. No, I'm not going to buy 10, buy 20. That'd be great.
All right. Well, thank you, Michael, for coming on the show and dealing with, obviously, some technical issues and basically just being awesome.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to be here. It was a lot of fun.
Excellent. And we will see everybody next week with whatever. I don't know what's happening next week. So, bye.
Good night.
Good night.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.